food news. I have a couple of books to share with you. On the news side of things, I guess I had, I just put a couple of new things up, and we don't have to look at them in detail, but there is a big cancer lawsuit going on about Roundup, which is, has been kind of going on for a while, but I think it had a news moment in January, so I think I caught a couple of articles about that. As we know from our studies, that's a big deal because genetically modified crops were modified in part to resist Roundup, and the productivity gains are enormous. Nobody disputes that. There are various reasons why you might still be concerned about that, and of course one of them would be if it causes cancer. Then I was thinking, well, where do you get food news? And so I did a little Google search on food news, and there's this this is a science-y site, but it's a place you guys might want to click in very once in a while just to kind of see some this kind of food news, right? There's all kinds of food news, legal food news, nutritional food news. And there was a pretty good article on eating and inflammation. It made a point that related to last class, which is that we were talking about nutritionism, right, and how, you know, taking a reductive attitude toward food can be problematic, even though you do discover things like vitamins, and there's important research that you get that way. And so eating and inflammation is an interesting example of the holism of food, because this article goes into how, I've never really had it put to me this way, it's kind of news for me, how eating prompts an inflammatory response, because you take in a lot of bacteria when you eat. So, I mean, inevitably, right? It's not a bad thing. I mean, it could be a bad thing. But it's actually a good thing if your immune response, if you have a holistic immune response each time you eat, because that builds up a healthier response, and it's considered good for your immune system. So if you eat sterilized foods, which often industrial foods are, they're absolutely sterile, then you don't get the same immune response. And this article goes into the different immune response, different inflammatory responses that people in different health conditions, dietary health conditions, experience. So I'll just throw that out. Any food news on your side? Anything come up? Things you notice? Questions? It could be questions that you kind of encounter.
I found one that scientists think they found the gene to make tomatoes taste like they're supposed to.
Oh, how interesting. That would be great. So they could put it back in, maybe?
Yeah, like after they already modified them to
yeah.
be bigger.
Yeah. That's neat. You know, there's we don't usually think of genetics and taste. So that's kind of a neat detail. There's a whole theory about it. There's the theory about how we smell and taste things is actually not that old. And it's a really complicated story. So the idea that there's a genetic side to that kind of makes sense. Yeah. Good. Anything else? Yeah. So I brought two books. One is there are a couple of articles about the microbiome. So if you want to kind of dip your toe in the microbiome literature, there's a few articles there. But this is my favorite, hands down. Okay, you just got to love this story. This is a microbiologist couple at Stanford, and they both study the microbiome. I mean, how cool is that? And they're raising a family, and they talk about how they feed their kids on the basis of what they think their research is showing them. And you know, when you study the microbiome, you're studying, you know, a lot of the material you're actually studying is from the intestines. And so it's kind of a romantic story. but, you know, you can imagine the dinner table conversation. You know, like, so anyway, it's one of the hottest food stories maybe in the last 20 years. So it's this whole area of research. They have high levels of authoritativeness being at Stanford and being primary researchers. There are article forms of some of their research. So if this appeals to you, there's a lot going on in your gut. And we'll probably sample, well, we won't sample what's going on in your gut, but we'll sample some of the knowledge about that. This is a book I'm very excited to receive. I ran across this in a bookstore in a different city, and it's a book which gives you photographic images of some of the chemicals in your food. And, you know, those are usually invisible, right? And so... So this is a kind of food photography project, but it's also got a serious, it's got an interesting, you know, it's not presenting an argument, but it's basically the first part is presenting you pictures, I'll pass it around, pictures of all these chemicals and their chemical makeup and what they're used in. And in the back, you should definitely, I put two index cards in here, in the back, there's a neat key to the various reasons why these chemicals are in your food. I mean, there are reasons for them to be there. And so check that out. And then there's a fun section at the back where they take some popular products, like this is Red Bull, and they kind of show you the chemicals in that product. So just kind of a fun thing. Not a narrative argument or anything. Okay. Anything else? Okay, good. So let's go ahead and do a little quiz. How about that? Kind of rehearse the reading with you, bring out the important details, take questions. We have time for some digressions on things that you found interesting or not. See, I'm not used to the whole light thing. I'm sorry. I think we can pretty much take it in this order, and then at about chapter 7 in pollen, I think chapter 7 gives us the basis for a really neat small group discussion, which has a prompt to it, which you can see if you want, really. But let's take a look at what Montanari is saying. It's kind of a small point. There's just 3 pages. I think it introduces a pretty important concept for gastronomy. You know, we're bleeding over now from sampling the nutrition section of the course. You could say that with pollen, we're getting a few things. We're getting the comment on nutrition, the theory of nutritionism. We're also getting, you know, some analysis of the U.S. food system. This chapter 7 that we're going to do a discussion thing on really brings in a new topic for us, food culture. So what else is there to food in addition to the politics and the nutrition questions, right? And the questions about industrial food systems, right? Those are all things we've had in the air. But in addition to all that, today we're going to kind of start to sample the unit on gastronomy. Right, so gastronomy brings in concepts like cucina. So let's get to that. Takes us to Montanari. So he's really got 2 points for my purposes, and then I'd like you to take out that reading. And do you have that reading handy? 29 to 33 from the Montanari PDF. First point is just that cooking is like agriculture. Cooking is a mark. Point for your notes. Cooking is a marker of civilization. Cuisines are taken to be sources of pride about cultivation, being civilized. Cooking is essential to that. So in the West, we're a little more dominantly oriented toward fire, and he makes the suggestion that our Prometheus myth kind of reinforces that. The hearth is identified with a human abode. That's kind of a core symbol of human living, as opposed to, say, living in the wild. Now he takes that back a little bit, too, in the second point. He says, that's a little overbroad because not all cuisines distinguish themselves by cooking. I mean, there's sushi, there's Korean cuisine has a lot of pickling in it, right? There's preservative. The food is transformed through chemical conservation. And preserving is also not just a conservation. There's a kind of chemical cooking process in preserving. I don't know if that's quite the right word, but, you know, there's the food is transformed when it's pickled. Let's say that, kimchi and things like that. Okay, so that was the main first point, takes it back a little bit, but the point is, and he cites this Chinese critic that Westerners are too focused on cooking. I don't know how to assess that. And the second thing I'd like is just this concept of cucina, and I like it because it's richer than we usually think of. When we think of gastronomy, they say, oh, you're a real gourmet, right? What do we usually think of in this culture? You go into somebody's house and say, oh, yeah, she is a real gourmet. What are you expecting?
Good food.
Yeah, you're expecting this person can make food. I'll say, wow, I can't make that food, right? Or a gourmet restaurant or a high-end restaurant. You expect to be wowed with a level of what, you know, usually we'll use this phrase, haute cuisine, right? So cucina, cooking and cuisine could refer to elite, extraordinary cuisine that chefs are capable of producing. But what I like about this concept of cucina is it's much more embedded in the everyday practice. And this is kind of something that I agree with other writers who say that we need to recover these practices. So let's highlight them in your notes. Cucina refers to the scene of cooking. It also refers to the repertoire of the cook, but it also refers to the total set of practices for handling food. And that's a bigger domain. Let's see if we can figure out what's in that. The total set of practices. So this would be the whole, I mean, the buzzword today is supply chain. This is the personal, your personal supply chain, right? That's included. When you get your food, where you get it, what kinds of food you buy, how you store them, how you consume them, what dishes you make. So recipes come in here somewhere, right? So cucina refers to the entire set of embedded social practices. Do you eat alone? Do you always eat with friends? How often do you go out? Cucina refers to the entire set of social practices which you use to manage your diet, right? And that's nice because it kind of revives the thicker notion of cooking. Cooking isn't just about getting some of this stuff in your mouth. Eating food, right? Food isn't just the food itself, right? That's kind of reductive now in our thinking, right? It's not nutritionism. That's another problem of reduction. But you could also be reductive by kind of like treating the problem of food as just about the thing that you're going to eat, right? But cucina brings in all the practices around it. So we're in a drive-through culture. So part of our repertoire for handling food is to periodically go through a drive-through window, right? Well, I mean, not through the window, but like alongside it, okay? Any comments? Do you guys want to add some details to this? What else do you associate? What other concrete things can we associate with this to kind of fill this concept out? Still kind of abstract when you say total set of practices. Like, do you cook from, I'll start the list. Let's get the list going with you guys. Like, do you cook from scratch or do you use prepared foods? That would be an item. It's relevant to your cucina. Let's get like 10 items in a couple of minutes. What else? Yeah, do you use, what's your equipment? Your cucina includes, I kind of think of kitchens as laboratories. In fact, in some languages, they're called laboratorio. You know, they use words that mix with a workshop. So what tools do you use? What's your workshop look like? Yeah, the others?
Yeah.
Display the finished product. Like,
yeah,
people
good.
Display and other people
Good. What's your presentation like? What's the message you send through the way you eat and consume food? Are you casual about it? Do you just kind of eat out of the bowl? Do you set a little placemat, light a candle? Right? We're going to talk about the restaurant today. There's a lot of cool things. There's a lot of cool fantasy dimensions to the restaurant. But cucina could include what you do at a domestic level that creates the aesthetic atmosphere, right? What does it mean to set the table? Setting the table is one of the practices of cucina. You add that to the list. How do you set the, do you set the table? Do you have a table? No. We're talking about the couch, my books, and the TV. That's kind of my cucina. Right. What else? What else do you want to add to your cucina? I would like you to take a challenge this semester to develop your cucina, to develop your set of practices, to kind of think outside of the practices of your culture. So we'll do some discussion of that today. Really appropriate them, you know. Okay, anything else? Whether you use spices and herbs, or whether you cook plain, whether you follow a recipe, or whether you're kind of an ingredient intuitive person, give me some more descriptors of, you guys have been over to each other's places. I mean, you notice this when you see somebody else's kitchen. Traditionally, it really refers to how typically a woman keeps the kitchen of the household. So it really refers to, put it on your list, homo economicus. Man as an economic agent. Food being traditionally, before we got rich, what you spent most of your money on and what you were most anxious about. Remember, until early 20th century, even in this wealthy country, food insecurity was an issue. Undernourishment was an issue, right? So cucina refers to the practices that govern the most important economic center of a household. How you're going to feed the people in your household. It's really huge. And it's fraught with all kinds of gendered associations. It's obviously got its politics. Okay, so anything else from this passage? Yeah, good. Okay. Pollan then picks up the... what I like about the trajectory of this 40 pages is that he picks up the story of the lipid hypothesis.
Remember, we kind of tracked that a little bit last time. We got the story about nutritionism, and remember we had that, go flip back to your notes just to remind yourselves, we had that three-way diagram of, right, government was over here,
food industry,
government, nutritionists, right? And we talked about how nutritionism was kind of the ideology, according to Pollan, the ideology that helped solve some of the impasses in politics and so on, right? So he's continuing that story, not at a political level so much, but now kind of at the level of investigating the hypothesis itself. So let's start our notes there. What was the fate of the lipid hypothesis? Let's start with notes there. That might actually be where a study question goes, right? And here he says, look, you know, there was a scientific retraction of the lipid hypothesis. It was kind of quiet, and you know, and the people who advocated it did advocate trans fats as a relatively okay fat. But we've learned a lot more about fats, and we've learned that that sometimes what matters is that this is a new area of research. It's not new means 2 to 3 decades, right? If you're talking about research, because you know there's a new result that could be like, oh my God, last year we got this stunning new result. But when I say new research, I mean like a decade or two is kind of new. And so one of the exciting new research areas is that you may have heard of. How many of you have heard of omega-3 fats versus omega-6 fats? Good. Anybody else? Yeah. Okay, good. So this book, if you have a kind of chemistry background, this is a little bit over my head, but it's a really great book, The Queen of Fats, and it's a very short book. It has some technical stuff, you know, so if you have some chemistry behind you, that's a really good thing. It was readable for me, and I don't have a lot of technical chemistry capacity. But it tells the story of the discovery of diverse kinds of fats and the effects, the possible different effects that an omega-3, we'll get into this a little bit more detailed later, but the different health effects that a higher proportion of omega-3 fats might have in your diet versus omega-6. So put it in your notes this way. Part of the problem with the lipid hypothesis is that it didn't track relatively new knowledge about types of fats and balances of fats, right? So grass-fed milk, cows that feed on grass have higher proportions of omega-3 fats in their milk than omega-6, than grain-fed cows. And we also learned that low-fat diets were not necessarily associated with weight loss. So we got a lot of research results that suggested that, in fact, if you reduce your fat, right, the big effect was, we learned this in the next chapter, we reduced the fat, but we did it as reduced the percentage of calories from fat by increasing the percentage of calories from carbs. So if your low-fat diet is about eating more carbs, then it turns out a lot of people gain weight from that, especially if you're eating refined carbs, right? So some of this is going to sound repetitious, but give me a nod and I'll stop reminding you of all this. And what's the problem with refined carbs? It has a kind of insulin response, right? Hypoglycemic index. Foods now carry a glycemic index, which is a measure of how quickly they turn into sugar. Carbs carry a measure on some nutrition sites. You know. So a high glycemic response is associated with high spiked insulin production and production of fat and suppression of signals for hunger. So that's all a bit repetitious, but we'll get that in there. So this is kind of what happened to the lipid hypothesis. We had competing evidence that it didn't reduce weight. We had evidence that that in combination with higher carbs, it might increase weight. There is actually a relationship between cholesterol and coronary heart disease, but it's not clear whether it's a cause or effect of the onset of the heart disease. And a lot of cholesterol is produced by your body. It's not related to dietary cholesterol. So there's a cholesterol story that we'll unpack when we get to talk about fats more technically. But our initial view of cholesterol is you go to the doctor, you get a blood test, he gives you a number, she gives you a number for your cholesterol, and then you get all upset about how you have to kind of like stop eating fat. And that's the advice my parents got. That's the advice I get from my doctor. I mean, he's a doctor, contemporary doctor, he's not much older than you guys. And that's what he's saying. You know, well, we can check your cholesterol. And like, so anyway, cholesterol is more complicated. It is related to correlate. There are correlations with coronary heart disease, but it's not clear that that's a causal relationship. It's really complicated. Those of you with science backgrounds, physiology backgrounds, sports, physical therapy, biology, nursing, if you want to dive into some of these medical and technical topics, let's do it. You know, there's some really good stories to tell. And bringing that back to the class and being able to put a technical story like the Queen of Fat story back to the class in 20 minutes in a useful way, that's really valuable. So if you're inclined to do that, I want to encourage you to do that. Wait, questions about this? I'd like to get to this juicy part here. No pun intended. So you got this idea of nutrients becoming labeled bad, fad nutrients, right? So so in Kellogg's day, it was protein, and in our day, it's fat, right? So you got this idea of nutritionism giving rise to kind of a fad, good and bad nutrients. And the guy who blew the story on, this is kind of good to know, because Gary Taubes was in our documentaries. The guy who blew the story on the lipid hypothesis of food journalist was Gary Taubes. Okay? And then, so then he takes a turn in chapter 7, which I think is really cool. And now, so now we'll move away from the fat discussion, and we're going to move into the food culture discussion. Could you just take a minute and help me remind each other, remind us about, so what is he, what are, let's get like five things from this chapter right away that he thinks mark American food culture. Yeah, did, remember, page through the chapter, did you bring it with you? Yeah, go ahead and take it. Hey, what pages are we talking about? Chapter 7?
41 through 80.
Yeah, well, okay, so chapters, yeah, and then right 53. Just page through that. This is where he starts to get into food culture a bit, which, of course, we're going to do as well when we talk about the restaurant. That's food culture. What does he mean by calling American food culture puritanical or Puritan? Let's start there. Take a minute. No rush. Cultures vary. Put your notes, start your notes this way. Chapter 7, pollen, right? Cultures vary in their attention to pleasure in food, right? So how would you evaluate American culture in terms of that? What does it mean to say that we have a puritanical food culture? Doesn't sound good. Maybe I'm offended. I don't know. What do you think? Sure.
It kind of looks down on people that enjoy food for the pleasure of it. I think the book talked about, like, they showed an American, like, a piece of cake, and they associated it with the word guilt. And they showed a French person the picture of cake, and they associated it with, like, a celebration.
Right. So our food, good, our food is, was that in this chapter? I missed that. Wow.
Or, I don't know if it was
okay.
Just in the reading.
Yeah, good. So our food psychology includes associations with food and morality, guilty pleasures. Or food and pleasure, like happy moments, celebrations. Good. Yeah, that's very helpful. So American food puritanism is, the hypothesis is, this comes out of Harvey Levinstein's work. He's got a couple of really good food books. And it's the idea that just as we are a remarkably religious culture, you know that, right? Compared to other Western industrialized countries, we're remarkably, our religious participation is like off the charts. Just as we're a remarkably religious culture, that religion is felt in our food culture in the form of a kind of distrust of pleasure in food, that we should emphasize abundance of food over rarefied pleasures. There's also an association that enjoying food as a gourmand is a feat. It's not manly. It's superficial. It's a kind of indulgence, right? You should feel guilty about wanting to eat really tasty food. You should be focusing on inexpensive, basic foods. And I may have mentioned that I really like this history of, got all excited about this history of meat in the U.S. that this food historian wrote. And she makes a point that when meat prices went up, or commodity prices even went up in the U.S., there would be big protests. What people consistently have wanted in American history is inexpensive, an abundance of inexpensive calories. That's really important, right? Let's think about how that fits in with a lot of the food system that we have. We're going to read an article by a woman, Zepeda, who makes this point in a few days. And we've got the food system that our culture wants. Our culture demands a food system where you get food efficiently, inexpensively. We're a very price-conscious food culture. We already had this in the record, we spend the lowest percentage of our income of any rich country on food. We don't want to spend a lot of our money on food. The Europeans are up around 15-17%. It's not those Mediterraneans. You know, they just like to hang out and eat good food. Although they're eating more bad food now. Does that help? You got this quote from Kellogg about that. Do you have a sense of what... I thought you guys would have that a little closer to your fingertips. Do you have a sense of what we mean by American food puritanism?
I just, could you explain it better?
Sure.
Like, how can you want, an abundant supply of cheap food, but then also feel guilty when we eat cheap food, like maybe a hamburger or something?
Well, that recent feeling of guilt about eating a hamburger might need an explanation, a more recent explanation, because this is a hypothesis about our history. So if you reach back further, you could say that we feel guilty not about eating inexpensive food, we feel guilty about eating gourmet food. That it seemed Americans are very frugal about their food system. They want, they protest when beef gets expensive, they expect food to cost relatively small percentage of income, right? So that the Puritanism is a kind of pleasure denying, it's associated with Puritan religious culture, right? Which was a pleasure denying, celebration denying, no dancing, no drinking, right? So that it's really about the measure of hedonism and willingness to enjoy food and its occasions. When I used to supervise Arabic instructors from different countries, all of them said at some point, "So where is everybody? Where is everybody? When do people hang out? Sit in cafes and eat food and drink things and just kind of hang out and have a scene. You know, we're going to talk about the restaurant as a scene today. Americans aren't. We do have our food scenes. We have our food malls, right? We have restaurants. But we don't do what a lot of countries do, which is just spend a lot of time in each other's company eating and drinking and looking at each other. Cafes are great for that, right? So that's just not who we are. And we go to Costco. We go, "Oh, man, I'll pay you $100 a year if you can give me food in quantity and price that just amazes me." You know, right? How many of you grew up in Costco households? Yeah, now we're talking. Costco, I mean, it's about pleasure, but it's about getting, a really great deal and filling the house with, food.
Do they have an idea of why? Okay, so historically, we don't want to spend our money on food. But, where did that come from? Are we allocating our money to?
That's a good question. You know, that's a really good question.
There are immigrants from other countries that value it, so what's...
Yeah, what? How did the... food historians tell this story. I can find some sources of it. How did the immigrants who came here from countries where food was valued more, what happened to them? Well, first of all, a lot of them were... I'm just thinking off the top of my head. A lot of them were starving. Right? So they weren't like the wealthy people hanging out in cafes in Paris. They were like my ancestors coming out of salt mines in Sicily and saying, "Oh my God, you come to America." We have stories of immigrants writing back to the home country and saying, "You can eat steak here every day. You know, and people are like, oh my God, you're kidding? Really? And it's like, it's a food fantasy. It's like the land of cocaine, you know, or Eden, where there's just... So yeah, part of the answer, let's puzzle it out. That's a really good question. Where did that come from is your question. And like, so we got this attitude. Well, we're a country of immigrants who came from really bad situations. We're also a country of homesteaders who were food vulnerable as we were expanding across the country. I mean, think about what Western expansion really was like at a family level. Like, you're going to all get in this transport and kind of go out and stake a claim. What are you going to be most worried about? You're getting into a pretty primitive food environment. You know, so, and then don't forget that we've had food scarcity in this country until the 50s. So European countries had gotten over food. Well, it depends on the gradient. There, you got the north-south barrier, but this would be an interesting thing to research. My impression is that prior to World War II, there was less food insecurity in Europe than the U.S., but I don't know that for sure. So yeah, that's how you puzzle it out. Really good question. You just keep thinking, well, who are we? How did we get here? What was our experience? And you kind of, and then there's the religious overlay. We're settled by people who had puritanical religious roots. So they were oriented that way. Great. Thanks for getting us to do that. Yeah. Okay, good. So let's do this in groups. The prompt that I hope this is helpful. I want to kind of personalize this. I want you guys to personalize this. So I'd like us to get a richer idea of what food culture means in our own lives now, because you've got some big data points now since chapter 7. You know what we're talking about now when we talk about food culture. So when did you first become aware of your food culture? That is, you and your family had a distinct food culture. Was it in noticing a difference between your family's food culture and then friends who came over? Or your food culture of origin and then the bigger society? Was it when you traveled? Is that when you noticed that you had a different food culture than... that your food culture wasn't, like, normal? That it was your food culture, not somebody else's, right? Was it last week? You know, are you, like, starting to think about food culture now? One of my experiences, I'll just throw this out because we're going to talk about the restaurant. This might help prime your own. You can also think about Gopnik's story about Hojo's and Parisian restaurants, but that got me thinking that, like, if I were doing your group work, one thing that would be on my mind is when I was growing up, you know, my parents were children of Sicilian immigrants, and they were also Depression, you know, this is like your grandparents, like, they lived through the Depression. That's another factor in explaining our food attitudes, right? We're two generations, three now, from the Depression. And they had very frugal attitudes toward food, so we were growing up in this really rich part of Connecticut. And at some point, I just realized, and my friends were talking about it, like, so can we go to a restaurant? And my parents were just like, there's just no way we're going to go to a restaurant. That's just a waste of money. And you know, and I'd be at school, and my friends would be like, oh, do you go to this Carol's for hamburgers? And that was kind of a new thing, to go to, like, a cheap place to eat and get a hamburger, you know. And my parents were just dying. And I was very young. I didn't realize that was a moment when I thought about my food culture. But it was a moment that I realized, wow, my family doesn't share, I didn't say it this way to myself when I was 8 years old, okay? My family doesn't share all the assumptions of the larger food culture. Now, one thing you might notice in small groups is that maybe your family does share. Maybe it has very American food culture. But try to get a discussion going within your group and try to invite participation from people in the group on this question. When did you first become aware of your food culture? And let me add a follow-up question, which I should have had in there. What are some of the hallmarks of your food culture? Your family food culture, your ethnic food culture, or the food culture of the town and place that you grew up? Because where you grew up also influences your food culture, right? Grew up in a rural place versus an urban place. All right, let's give that and try to keep track of some results. I'm really curious to see what you come up with here. So let's get into groups and give that about 7 to 8, 9 minutes. Okay. All right. So what kind of things did you came up in your groups? What kinds of things did you reference to identify your food culture, or the moment at which you kind of became aware that, hey, you know, my food culture is not quite the same as everybody else's? How do we do that?
Yeah,
came up, yeah.
So my mom's Portuguese, and Portuguese mothers are a lot like Italian mothers with their food. There's, like, always tons of it.
Right.
And I think the first time I, like, ever became aware of that was when friends would come over, and it's like,
right.
Why is there so much food on the table?
Right.
It's like,
right.
What do you mean? Like,
right.
Dinner time.
Does she like push the food too?
In a very, very nice way.
Eat well. Oh,
yeah.
Do you want more?
Here you go. Here's another plate.
When you were growing up, would she put food on your plate without asking you?
Yeah.
That's because she loves you.
Yeah, that's true.
So we're finding food culture is gendered, thoroughly gendered, right? Things are changing, but it's still very liberal, egalitarian couples. The guy still marches out to do the grilling because he's the man. Good. Other things. Let's get a bunch of data out here.
So I noticed mine right away. My best friend is Greek, and so her family is, they definitely have a great food culture, and their entire culture is surrounded by food.
That's great.
So I thought that was very interesting. My family is German. We're more of like meat and potatoes. We kind of talked about that in our group, meat and potatoes over here.
Good.
Yeah, and then they are more of like light salads, constantly having just light food around the house, just giving us something even when we're walking in. Compared to my parents that are like, just go ahead and grab something pretty much. So.
What you're bringing out is something I should have highlighted, but it's great that you brought it out. Is assimilation is a variable in cultural transmission that determines that some people retain more of their culture of origin practices, food practices included. And so Greek, Italian, Portuguese, we've identified already as cultures that retain more of their food culture. Although Italian Americans are very assimilationist in a lot of ways. They, you know, my family pursued a very assimilationist strategy. So, but if I showed you, if I could show you a picture of the first time we tried to make hamburgers at home, you would say, wow, that looks like some people who don't really know what hamburgers are supposed to look like. You know, what else? Let's get some more things out. Yeah.
So growing up, my dad was like always been in the restaurant business.
Good. Yeah.
And so I definitely grew up with like, I had a good appreciation for good food. I mean,
good.
Sushi like has been my favorite food when I was little and stuff.
That's neat.
But I think what I got from that was more an appreciation for like hospitality.
Right,
my dad
right.
was like really, really good at that. All the restaurants he works for, that's always what he
right,
does. Training
right,
and stuff.
Good.
And so going to restaurants now, I like good food, but I also look more for like the atmosphere and the experience
good.
And the hospitality.
Good. So your family's food connection to food through this through restaurants has affected the way you perceive restaurants as well. And that's going to come up. You should share some of these details with your dad about the Gopnik and the origin of the restaurant. Yeah, good. That's great. That's a really nice angle. Others, if you want, yeah.
So we talked more about what the eating experience was like, and my family growing up, we always ate dinner together.
Great.
We'd wait till like 9 o'clock if we had to, and all the
that's really
activities.
Great.
But I noticed it was unique because we had friends asking us to, like, come over for dinner.
Right.
So we always
and,
had, like,
right.
8 to 10 to 12 people eating with us. And my parents loved it. And there was, my brother's friend was an only child of divorced parents.
Good.
We didn't have that experience. So I think for 2 weeks in a row, he came to our house every night.
How fun.
Yeah.
So notice the variables that are coming up in this one account. Rigidity of meal practices, the value placed on meal. Could you tell your parents, hey, I'm not going to be at dinner tonight, I'm going somewhere, or would that be sacred? What else came up in that? Permeability of the table, how open was your family table to people dropping in and joining you for dinner at the drop of a hat? My family wouldn't have done that, you know, but we're maybe that's indicative of other things about us. Yeah, good. Good. I was thinking, while you guys were working, I was thinking about the point in my upbringing, a sad day, I think, when they rolled the TV up to the dinner table. I remember thinking, memory can be tricky. You could, like, falsely remember stuff. I remember liking the kind of, there were four siblings and two parents, and it was like, you know, we all yelled at each other, and we did less of that with the TV, and they thought that was a good thing, and I thought that was a bad thing. So what's supposed to happen when you eat, right? That's part of your food culture. What else? Let's get some more up. We had one? Joe? Okay, good. Other? Let's get one more.
Well, I just kind of recognized this over the past semester, but living with other people
right.
has different styles of
right.
cooking or different styles of food.
Right.
I lived with someone in the summer who, he's from Jordan.
Right.
And he makes everything with a bunch of different spices, all that kind of stuff. And then I am currently living with someone who microwaves everything and it's on paper plates. Like,
yeah, right.
There's no doing dishes or anything. So it's very different, very interesting to see a variety of people living under one roof but still having
right.
two cultures.
Yeah, that's good. You know, we tilted this exercise toward your family background, which I think was the right way to go, but there's a whole other exercise about your current food culture, right? I don't know how much I really want to know, but no, I do want to know. In fact, one thing, I started a list of survey questions that I was going to give you the first day. I thought, wow, the first day is a great time to ask a bunch of things about your food practices. And so I've got this list of like 20 questions. If anybody wants to take it further, you're welcome to. And I was very curious about things like, how often do you go out to eat? How often do you eat fast food? Do you cook a meal at home? Do you eat alone most of the time? Do you eat with your roommates? How do you manage group houses where everybody's got different things? You know, all these things about your current food culture, right? Would any comments about your, that started us off, any comments about current food culture?
Yeah, we talked about that too. Like, there's differences of people who's, well, like, each individual house will live together, and, like, that entire house is, they'll go to Costco, and, like, they'll just split it and they'll cook for
right.
each other. It's just
right.
So different.
More communal group houses versus more libertarian group houses, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's like every zag for themselves, right? So you're in a pretty communal group house.
I'm not.
Oh, you're
no,
not? Okay.
My house is too
big. Okay, yeah, good. How many of you had family food cultures where you actually kind of ate different things? Yeah. That's becoming more common. People write about that. And that's relevant to the restaurant, because that's one of the innovations of the restaurant. Everybody can eat their own thing. Yeah. Anything else on this? Yeah, please.
Something in college that I think popped up that I wouldn't have ever noticed before that is, you start living with other people who are young and noticing who got taught how to cook and who always
Good.
Cooked for them.
Good.
Not that either or is bad, but it's very interesting.
Good.
One of my best friends
Absolutely.
Could burn mac and cheese, like the crack
right.
kind.
The kind you open out of the package.
Yeah,
all right.
Like,
that's great.
She asked me how to make that once, and I didn't know how to answer.
Good. So that's a variable. Let's get that on your notes. How much cooking happened in your food culture? So we started with Montanari, talking about the centrality in food history of cooking. But not everybody's cooking. There's a food journalist who writes about this, and she's kind of also gone into the business of helping people learn how to cook. And she had this article where she was talking about how she was working with people in their 30s who were second generation men and women who didn't have a cooking tradition in their family. Like, their parents microwave stuff. So how much, and you know, let's just leave this question out there. Does it matter? Does it matter if you cook? Like, what's going to happen? What kind of food system, personal food system, do you wind up with if you cook versus you don't cook? I mean, that's a really big divide in the culture right now. We're cooking less and less. People's cooking skills are going away. Cooking is time-consuming. Most people see it as drudgery. Well, that was one of my survey questions. Do you enjoy cooking? You know, that's just a fundamental question.
Over the summer, I was camping for 6 weeks as part of my job, and one of the requirements was we get to know how to cook over a fire.
Yeah, yeah. How was that? Was that hard? Was it challenging?
No.
Not too bad. Once you get the hang of it, you got a nice source of heat there. That's great. Yeah, good. Others? Yeah, good. Cooking, I'm very curious about your cooking. How many of you, well, see, this is what the survey questions were meant to elicit. Yeah.
I think a big transition for me was coming out of, like, the dorms and moving into a house.
Yeah.
I knew I had to, like, start cooking for myself.
Yeah.
And my parents never, like, was cooked for me
right.
as a kid living at home. But I didn't want to just be, like, you know, microwave and, like, you know, freezer stuff and just put it in, like, oven for that. And so that entire summer I just basically spent a lot of time, like, teaching myself how to cook.
Good.
And over, like, the past 2 years it's been a huge change of, like,
oh, good.
Back then versus, like,
yeah,
like,
if you can.
How I took an hour
good.
To like prepare my food regularly, but now sometimes I'll take multiple days to prepare my food.
Great. Yeah, we're going to talk about practicality. So that's definitely a practicality issue, and how you manage that, right? That's your cucina. So that's, and that's also, there's a gender dimension to that. It may not be in your case, but men are typically not taught to cook as much as women, and the assumption is that you're going to have an egalitarian relationship, she's going to do a lot of the cooking. And that's still what a lot of couples find, is just the guys just come up with this kind of stupid, I don't want to do that. And so people, in the emotional psychology, you know, intimacy and food are obviously related. That gets us into the Gopnik piece, right? And so there's the gendered issue of how we teach men and women to cook and how we prepare you for that. And Sodexo is kind of a giant way of infantilizing you, right? Because you're here, you are 18 years old, your parents, like me, for my kids, I want you to focus on your studies, let's just put the food in front of you 3 times a day. So the meal plan just is the solution. But notice that it prolongs your infancy. If you didn't acquire cooking skills at home because you enjoyed your parents cooking for you, and doesn't that feel great, right? Can we just say that for some of you? You could agree, maybe not everybody. It feels great when you're fed by your parents. The natural sequence is to just delay your learning to do that. Yeah?
Or at least off the practicality for living in a house. If you live in a house where your roommates don't clean up after cooking,
right,
it could influence how much you want to cook.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because not only do you have to prep all your food, you also have to clean.
Absolutely.
Beforehand.
Absolutely.
All the academics you have, you don't even want to have like a house discussion at that point.
Yeah. No, we're going to get into this a lot. Good. This resonates for you guys? Yeah. Because part of your... Good. Part of your kuchina is how... Part of the way we can make food sacred is to eat in clean places and to have orderly kitchens. That's really hard to do in group houses, right? I've been in a lot of group houses over the years, and they're often not very appetizing. You know, there's usually a big garbage can that's like 3/4 full of like all the good.
Something else kind of similar to what John was saying is I've noticed if you didn't grow up learning how to cook, like I had housemates who asked me if they put liquid Dawn soap in the dishwasher, or they didn't know how to turn on our oven. And it's like...
Guys? These are guys?
No, these are women.
Really? Wow, that's interesting. Now I have to update my sense of how gendered this is. So it's maybe that men and women are less clued into kuchina, managing the house, but that men are just further behind. Yeah, please.
One thing I've noticed that's a little specific, I think,
sure,
to like Spokane is... there are the Four Seasons, but I think there's like an access to like a variety of different places to go get your food from, and especially in the spring and in the summer when they start opening the farmers market, there's a lot more like educational food. But,
absolutely.
I have a few friends that go to USC, and like it's in the middle of South Central LA, and so it's more of a food desert there, so they have to rely on their dining hall and their food there,
right,
but they're not getting like education, and it's
absolutely
also a bigger city, like.
Absolutely. Good.
There, so.
No, this is a whole dimension to food culture. Like, your food culture is influenced by what's available to you. What kind of a food system, desert versus jungle, right? You know, that's really good. That's very helpful. And we were, you know, at the period of time you're growing up in a household is also, there's changes happening during that period in the culture. So you've got the development of the industrial food system and how it impacts the family. Okay, great job. That's I'm glad we spent the extra few minutes on it. I really wanted to develop that further, so thanks a lot. Okay, let's talk about the origin of the restaurant. I hope you found this interesting. The first thing to focus on in your notes is the theatrical dimension of a restaurant. The fact that a restaurant is a place of fantasy, that it's a place where you... Remember how he describes the restaurant? There's going to be a guy in a badly dressed, like the maitre d' in a fancy... restaurant kind of looks like he's wearing like a bad suit, or it could be it's a woman now. But he kind of describes the illusion of a dining room. And it's a place that we connect with romance. We have time, right? Good. So that's the first thing to get going about the restaurant, is that it has a dimension of artifice, theater, fantasy. Not all restaurants, but the restaurant in its origin here, and a lot of restaurants today, right? The second thing to get into is this question of origin. So the old theory, make sure you're clear about this, the old theory was that restaurants began when the French Revolution occurred because people were putting their help out because it disrupted aristocratic lifestyles, and so you had a lot of people on the market with domestic skills. And that was the theory for a while. And then there's this really important food sociologist, Priscilla, she's a great name, and she writes really well. She's a Columbia U faculty, you know, retiring now. Priscilla Park Ferguson gets mentioned here because she helped change this theory. And she pointed out that, in fact, the restaurant developed about 20 years before the revolution, there had already been a movement toward egalitarianism in the culture, right? Class distinctions were breaking down. So the idea of going to a place with mixed class, socioeconomic classes, was more plausible. But he identifies three factors. Let's get clear on this. Intellectual causes, commercial causes, and moral social causes. So the intellectual causes, and this is really important, the intellectual causes were that the origin of the restaurant was tied to a health food craze. Restaurant originally refers to restore. Restoratives were the fare of the original restaurants. And the restorative in principle was bouillon. It was a French soup that was going to restore you. As the restaurant, and then there was a commercial dimension to this. We had this site, any Paris visitors would know this, Palais Royal is still a very central and important site in Paris. And so you had this area that got developed as a very public scene to go to restaurants. So the public performance of going out to eat was a dimension of the original restaurant. We already mentioned the moral social causes. But what was a restaurant fundamentally? What distinguished it from... So make sure you're clear in your notes and your thinking that there's always been places to get food, right? Because there's always been travelers, and travelers don't have kitchens with them. So there's always been pubs, often linked to travel routes, sort of like our highway stops now with fast food places, right? There's always been that. There's also always been caterers. So a table d'hôte and a traiteur are different forms of eateries that existed already. But what's distinctive about the restaurant? Let's see if we can get at that. So it started out serving healthy food. It served foods that were sourced from places that you couldn't get. This is kind of important. Remember we talked last time about gastronomy being conquering space and time. The Gonzaga family sends the horse rider with money south to get the strawberries for the queen, whatever it was. So this is kind of an example of that you would get things from the regions of France that were fresh foods that would not normally be brought into Paris or that you couldn't access. Everybody would pick their own meal off of a menu. That wouldn't be true for other kinds of pubs where you would kind of, there'd be like a board and this is the food we have and do you want it, right? So the menu, Russian service versus French banquet service. Can anybody help us with that? What is the difference between French banquet service versus Russian service? Ironically, this is confusing. I was going to make it a quiz question. The French restaurant began, put in your notes, by adopting Russian service, by not continuing banquet service. So can anybody give us an image of the difference? Yes.
The Russian service, like the big long table, and like they said you eat whatever is closest to you or something.
That's not a detail. Let's go back and get that.
I
missed that.
The service people understand, they stare at you like.
Well, that would be true of like the domestic suit in a manner, right? They'd be standing there. You know, you've seen your Downton Abbey store shows and stuff. Yeah, but. I may have missed that detail. The big distinction for me was that somebody else has this? Yeah.
So like Russian, each person has like an individual plate for the French. Like he said it was like a big banquet,
yeah.
But the servants were
domes. Right. So individual plates and courses. Let's get that in your notes. So Russian services where there's going to be a sequence of courses and people are going to make individual choices. Banquet service is more where you're going to have food piled up on a big buffet or banquet table, and you're going to be served portions from that. So the food's kind of on display, and the job of the waiter is to kind of portion it out to you. Yeah, I think that's the distinction. Now, the restaurant changed in its first few decades, so let's get this into the picture. It starts out as having this health food dimension, but then it becomes, under the influence of this chantoiseau, under the influence of this guy, restaurants moved more toward offering a pleasure experience, not necessarily a restorative experience. So very quickly, the restaurant became a scene of pleasure. And it was very important that women could go out. This was our quiz question, right? This was a place where women could go out in public together without scandal because they were doing it for their health originally. and then it kind of transfers into. This is also the first. This is the scene of the first window stickers with restaurant evaluations. Notice the explosion of gastronomy is often associated with rating systems, right? So there's beer and coffee rating now for minute, subtle differences, which I can't often taste. But likewise with restaurants. How many restaurants don't have a sticker of some kind on the window, which is part of a way of telling you, you know, how good a restaurant it is. Okay. Let's see what else we've got in here. Yeah, we've already brought in this idea from Park Ferguson of the restaurant as a social field is the abstract concept, but the concrete concept is that it's a scene. It becomes a place that you associate with a particular kind of activity, maybe a date. It may, earlier you get, Gopnik refers to writers and restaurants hanging out. There's bohemian restaurant culture is about having the time to spend hours at a cafe, right, and to identify yourself with that leisure, maybe artistic culture. Okay, let's see, I think we pretty much have. Oh, let's leave for a few minutes. Let's take our last few minutes then to talk a little bit about this assignment that some of you expressed interest in. So, any questions about that? Are we good? We'll get a little more on the emergence of the restaurant. And then we're gonna also be sampling our ethics unit with that Singer and Mason chapter later in the week. So let's just take a minute in case some of you have questions about this, and maybe I didn't leave enough time. I added a little detail to this assignment because some of you have expressed interest in doing at least the first step of this assignment. So just briefly, I just wanted to point out minimally that I added this, and then if you have questions, fine. Otherwise, we'll break. So the part I added was just some prompts. So you may want to focus on a general, you have some room on what you're focused on because you might have things that you're interested in. But you might want to focus on a general comparison of your diet to the guidelines. You might identify things that you were surprised about, the amount of a certain kind of food or the lack of a certain kind of food. So keeping track is about being able to make visible what you think you know, but which you may be surprised about. So those are the kinds of prompts to consider. How much whole food versus industrial food? How regular is your diet? Like, what does it, is it kind of like kind of the same thing most days? Or is it kind of fits and starts? Does cooking come into play consistently? Or does cooking appear and then kind of disappear when you get busy, right? So those are kind of things that that you might be interested in. Why don't we break now? And we've got a few minutes. I'm here till the next class. So if you're doing this assignment and you have specific questions, hang out and we'll talk.